Republicans release their proposed Senate redistricting map, a plea for improving traffic safety, plus locally licensing educators and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 24th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana Senate Republicans unveiled their redistricting proposal for the state Senate district lines. The map will help decide who represents every Hoosier for the next decade. An analysis of the proposed Senate map projects Democrats will lose one district but gain a newly created seat, while another Democratic district becomes extremely competitive. Meanwhile, Republicans appear unlikely to lose any seats, while most of their incumbents are safer. Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says Republicans aligned their priorities with what he says the public wants.
In terms of compactness and keeping communities of interest together,
but critics point to the proposal splitting West Lafayette and Lafayette into two separate districts and carving up the south side of Fort Wayne into three different Senate seats as evidence to the contrary. The Senate Elections Committee will hold a public hearing on the map Monday. Are the Senate maps really compact and keeping communities of interest together? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, if you look at the House map, it looks, to the naked eye, real compact. The districts seem to make a lot of sense. Looking at that Senate map, does it look compact to you?
Well, first, the House Republican map looks, just looking at it, like you said, the lines are clean. They have 90-degree angles. They look particularly compact if you put them against the House Democrat-drawn maps in 2001. That is, Matt Lehman on the floor of the House this week said looked like someone was trying to draw them to look like a salamander. They twisted and turned and grabbed a house here and a block there and were gerrymandered to make sure Democrats had control of the House for a decade, which they mostly succeeded at. Until voters all changed their mind and for very good policy reasons started voting Republican in 2010. But the question on the Senate Republican maps, they not only look compact, but the math behind them supports that view. 96% of the, when you talk about communities of interest remaining intact, 96% of the townships remained whole, 92% of cities and towns remain whole. West Lafayette and Lafayette are two big cities, and they're two separate cities. So making them two separate districts isn't that dramatic, I don't think. And the number of whole counties that are intact, whether you're not splitting counties off into other districts, went from 49 to 65. So the math supports what the naked eye suggests, which is these maps on the House and Senate side and the congressional maps. If you look back at Andre Carson's district, when the Democrats drew it, it looked like a snowflake. Now it looks like a rectangle. And that's how it should be. This is one of the most partisan Republican states in the nation. You're going to have some of the most partisan Republican maps, and these were drawn with communities of interest in mind and political math and precinct math in mind.
And Delaney, Mike O'Brien just talked about the number of townships and cities and towns and counties that are kept whole in that Senate map. Doesn't that make it a good map?
Doesn't make it a good map. It was a very good defense, Mike, but it doesn't change the fact that this was a partisan map. Designed, not the only communities of interest that they're interested in are the incumbent Republicans in the House and the Senate. That's what these maps were designed to protect. Doesn't have anything to do with the voters. And by the way, yes, Indiana is a Republican state. Donald Trump got 58% of the vote. These maps give 80% of the seats in the Senate and 70% of the seats in the House to Republicans. That is gerrymandering, plain and simple. And when they talk about having it transparent, yeah, I hope they made that statement in an internal room so lightning didn't strike them dead. I mean, they didn't even have a hearing in the House before voting the Senate maps out. Didn't even have a hearing. All of these decisions, like all of the decisions affecting Indiana under the supermajority, are made behind closed doors in Republican caucuses. In other states with an aggressive pool of journalism out there and TV, we would have questions raised about how undemocratic this process is. Instead, we all just kind of shake our hands and say, well, that's the way it is in Indiana. Nonsense. It is nonsense because what they're doing is when we had the maps in 2001, Our majority was 2 votes, okay? 2 votes. Now you've got 80% in one and 70% in the other, and it is completely undemocratic.
It was a miracle you could have gerrymandered to a 2-vote margin, considering Republicans got 60% of the vote in the House. We made the same argument you're making now.
We carried the governor's office for 16 years, and we carried Obama as president. So don't tell me that this is...
Yeah, that was pretty much the end of it.
Nikki,
because she fixed the maps.
Nikki, let me...
Hey, why? What are you talking?
When you look at the Senate map, is there anything that sticks out or surprises you about it?
Well, interestingly, I said last week one of the big surprises for the House map was how they really, lessened the number of districts in Allen County. The Senate went the opposite way and carved Allen County and the city of Fort Wayne up into even more districts, I think 4 now instead of 3. I mean, I don't know what the south side of Fort Wayne has to do with Blackford and Jay counties. They don't have anything in common. So, I mean, that one is a big thing that stood out to me from where I am. Obviously, I'm also hearing a lot on the Lafayette, West Lafayette. Obviously, I think the House took a more status quo kind of approach, and it seems like the Senate sort of, went for the throat.
John Schwanes, if this is a partisan gerrymander, as Ann obviously contends, and many, many other people, it's obviously not just Ann, but if this is a partisan gerrymander...
Thank you, Brandon.
If this is a partisan gerrymander, quite frankly, does it matter in the sense that will there be any consequences for Republicans other than keeping their supermajorities?
Well, let's start off by stipulating that this is a partisan gerrymander. I mean, that is the process that I don't think anybody's... making any bones about that in terms of denying that there's some sense of partisanship here. That's to the victor go the spoils. And in the case of drawing maps every 10 years, there is a real trophy that goes with that victory and with control of the Indiana House and Senate. Having said that, you can come up with math to make just about any argument. It would be, I think, hard, for instance, Ann, to come up with maps that actually reflected the turnout or the vote breakdown in the last election. Those would probably be some pretty odd looking maps too, in part because Hoosier voters, for any number of reasons, seem to voted in greater numbers toward the Republican Party. Let me just finish. But having said that, I do think that there's numbers and math notwithstanding, there is sort of a smell test that we can apply just using Hoosier common sense. And in that regard, the Senate maps are problematic, it seems to me, in terms of dividing communities that, Lafayette and West Lafayette maybe see them. They are technically different cities, but I'm not sure that the folks who live there feel that they need a visa to go from, one to the other. And certainly Fort Wayne probably wonders why it's being carved up more than the turkey at Thanksgiving. And so the math, you can make any argument, but the smell test, those two are kind of tough to explain.
I think you can explain Lafayette. You can explain it by the fact that Ron Alting's district is trending Democratic, and they fix that.
I guess explaining
that's what that's all about.
How about defending? Different verb.
All right. Well, a pair of state lawmakers say drivers in Indiana need a hard reset in what's expected of them behind the wheel. Those lawmakers are proposing both short- and long-term solutions to reckless driving amid an increase in fatalities. Indiana traffic volume was down about 9% last year versus 2019, in part due to the pandemic, and yet traffic fatalities increased about 8%. Representative Mitch Gore says in the state's largest county, Marion County alone, traffic fatalities rose 31% last year.
Pressing enough, severe enough, and fixable enough to warrant some immediate attention.
That immediate attention would come in the form of federal coronavirus relief dollars. Gore and Representative Blake Johnson are asking the governor to release some of those funds to state and local law enforcement for overtime pay for increased traffic enforcement. Long term, they plan to offer a bill next session to allow traffic cameras in school zones. Traffic camera bills have repeatedly failed in the General Assembly, but Johnson says they have to keep trying.
We're tired of day after day seeing tragic headlines that lives are lost. We're tired of driving these streets every day and seeing firsthand the degree to which people are disregarding the law and the safety of others. And perhaps most of all, we are tired of reckless drivers getting away with it.
Just this year, a bill failed to pass that would have allowed traffic cameras on school bus stop arms.
Ann Delaney, can this narrow version of a traffic camera bill be the one that breaks through the gridlock at the legislature?
I hope so, because I think these representatives are exactly right. I mean, I've noticed myself out there, people going 50 and 60 miles an hour on city streets and running stop signs and running red lights and not being at all careful of going slower around school zones. I mean, you know, you have no expectation of privacy when you're a driver on the road. Your car has to be licensed. You have to be licensed. You're on public highways. There is no expectation of privacy. And the idea that you ought to be able to get away with it unless you happen to get caught by a police officer is crazy. I mean, either we want safety and we want to protect our children, particularly as they go to and from school or get on the school buses, or we don't. And putting cameras by school zones, it seems to me, is a very simple, very narrow way of trying to reform behavior that's become very, very reckless and life-endangering.
Mike O'Brien, we talked on the show before. This issue is one of the interesting ones at the State House because it's not Republican versus Democrat, conservative versus liberal. It crosses party lines, certainly. There are folks on both sides of the aisle who have both positions. But is this sort of approach that it's about protecting kids in school zones, is that the sort of thing that can be the magic formula to make it work?
Well, I mean, it is bipartisan. Representative Jim Pressel, the Republican chairman of the House Roads Committee, has carried the work zone piece version of this in the past, and that passed this committee unanimously last. Both Republicans and Democrats supported it, but it has a hard time with conservatives who don't like cameras generally, or suggest that, well, if we put them on school bus stop arms, then before you know it, they're going to be on every red light in the state. I don't think the politics would ever permit that. But, you know, I think I've said on the show before, this idea that we shouldn't use cameras to enforce behavior, one, we already do that. This isn't some, like, you know, threshold, social threshold we've got to go across. But just in terms of driving, it's no different than, like, when we invented the breathalyzer. If someone said, whoa, wait a minute, you can't use technology. No, it's no one's business how drunk I am in my car. You can't use a breathalyzer to prove it. The same principle applies here. We can use, you know, cameras can be used to enforce the law, and they are used to enforce the law, and whether it's work zones or school zones, they ought to be.
John Schwanes, kind of the same question, which is, well, we saw the traffic, the school bus stop arm camera bill not work out last session. Does that tell us all we need to know about the chances of this school zone camera bill next session?
I think it probably does. And this is based on history and the current makeup of the General Assembly. I doubt that there is going to be any significant change in sentiment, even though this is crafted as it is. No one's going to argue that they want to imperil certainly young Hoosier children, no. But I think Mike is right. There is a faction within the General Assembly, and it's a pretty large one, which explains why the stop arm bill did not prevail, and that is concerned about cameras of any type. The notion that it's somehow intrusive, that Big Brother, it's the first step en route to Big Brother. So I think while people would be willing to step up enforcement, more, you know, funding for overtime, police overtime, patrols and enforcement periods, I think that would be more acceptable to a lot of the people in this particular faction of the General Assembly than the introduction of cameras. So to answer your question, I think it probably will suffer the same fate as the stop arm bill.
Nikki, to wrap up this part of the conversation, the numbers certainly tell the story. Traffic was down and yet fatalities are up. But anecdotally, I mean, I don't know anybody that I've talked to who doesn't agree that traffic just seems worse. Drivers just seem worse. Does that kind of sentiment, can that start to move the needle a little bit as Hoosiers are getting frustrated with what they're seeing on the roadways?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, maybe we should just try the personal responsibility route and see how that's going to go.
It works well for everything else. Let's do it. All right. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Governor Holcomb use unspent federal coronavirus relief fund dollars to increase traffic safety enforcement? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you if President Biden was right to force companies to have their workers either get the COVID-19 vaccine or undergo weekly testing. A little surprised at the overwhelming nature of this. 81% of you say yes, 19% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, some Indiana lawmakers are weighing whether schools should have the option to locally license teachers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains it was a main point of conversation during the General Assembly's final Education Study Committee meeting this week.
The committee recommends the state explore ways to set teacher pay goals and expand pre-K opportunities and publish more resources to close education achievement gaps. In the face of teacher shortages, some lawmakers on the committee also expressed interest in granting schools the authority to locally license educators. But John O'Neill from the Indiana State Teachers Association says granting schools licensure authority comes with risks.
It could add to the inequality of credentials and experience across districts.
Ultimately, the committee's final report requested that the Indiana Department of Education weigh in on teacher licensing before the next legislative session.
Nikki Kelly, in the grand battle of local control that we see at the State House, is this one that makes sense for locals to decide?
I really don't know on this one. I do think there should be some minimum, level of expertise or certification. And I just know over the past decade, lawmakers have opened up again avenue after avenue after avenue, different routes, to bring professionals into the school. Hardly anyone has to have any actual pedagogy training anymore. So, I do think probably a minimum, amount of training it seems like a decent line to follow.
John Schwannis, is this one that you think locals will be fighting for at the State House or fighting against?
I'm sure some would. Yes, is the answer. Some will and some won't. I don't think ultimately it happens. It's a pretty big step. And talk about it, watching a tennis match in the General Assembly, back and forth. And this is how watching the General Assembly deal with the notion of local control as it relates to school administration over the past few years has been quite, Wimbledon kind of approach. Because on the one hand, salaries, I don't know, maybe that should be handled here. But teacher licensing, maybe that's handled here. Mask wearing and other safety mandates, that's handled here. There seems to be no consistency, surprise, surprise, because the whole philosophy turns on more narrow issues, as we've discussed many times before. I'm sure that it's a lot of appetite among some, some factions of the state, but it's a big change that I don't think would happen in the next session.
Mike O'Brien, would it be a good idea to let local school boards and things like that, school districts, license teachers?
That's how they do it, I think. I mean, if this is going to be an issue for school, I don't know what was recommended or if they talked around like how this would actually happen, whether it's a superintendent or district by district decision or if the school board's doing this. If the school board's doing it, it's a heck of a time to put something like this in front of the school board. These school board meetings have become fist fights on curriculum and sometimes literal fist fights over curriculum. you put a teacher in front of that board and they get to, thumbs up or thumbs down whether they have a license or not. I don't like inserting politics into that process, and I'm not sure that this is broken at the state level.
Yeah, Ann Delaney, this is again another attempt to say we don't have enough teachers. How can we do it? And this is not obviously the only answer, but it is potentially another answer. But is it in your mind going to help in any way solve the teacher shortage that Indiana is experiencing?
I think it's the worst idea I've heard this week, to tell you the truth. I mean, the idea that when you graduate,
redistricting.
Well, besides redistricting,
we did it.
We already knew that last week. So no, what I'm saying is, the idea that when you graduate with a certificate, then you would go school district by school district to find out if you're qualified is ridiculous. I mean, they're not in a position to make the decision. If we want more teachers, which we do, we want A, qualified teachers. We don't want to drop the requirements so much that they're not qualified. We want qualified teachers. The way you do that is to get the General Assembly out of the classroom and pay teachers adequately. Then the market, which the Republicans say they love so well, will work and people will gravitate towards that as a lifestyle choice. That's the only way to do it. Lowering the bar for teachers like this and having this decision made by every school district in the state is the most ridiculous idea I've heard.
All right. Well, child care providers from across the state gathered in Indianapolis recently to discuss how best to use a massive influx of pandemic relief funding aimed at early childhood education. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains for us again, staffing problems and capacity needs remain top of mind for many of them.
Providers may never see funding levels like this again. According to Early Learning Indiana, more than $1 billion in federal COVID-19 relief is coming to Indiana specifically for child care. Adrian Johnson owns a child care center in Indianapolis. She says her vision is to expand by buying the plaza space around her center.
It is for sale. So I'm like, this is a prime opportunity for us to be able to buy the whole thing. There's no reason why we can't.
Johnson and others at the event also say they're looking for ways to better train and pay staff. But the challenge, they say, is finding qualified people to hire and keeping them on the job.
John Tronis, obviously this funding isn't ongoing. Are child care providers sort of setting themselves up for a fall here?
You can't blame them for thinking big when these kinds of dollars are in the pipeline. And also, I'm not sure we can realistically say you have to use this self-discipline and marshal resources as if the pandemic never happened. A lot of these businesses, child care operators, suffered mightily, as did so many other sectors of the economy during this once-in-a-generation, once-in-a-lifetime sort of crisis that our society encountered. A lot of them are still reeling from that. So it will help shore them up, put them back on their feet. Maybe it's not a smart idea to acquire an old football stadium or basketball stadium and with the expectation of filling it with thousands of kids. Not that anybody's, that's a bit of hyperbole. But I think that, let's put it this way, I think the money will be well spent by a lot of people who have been hurting quite a bit because of COVID.
Yeah, Nikki, we hear this all the time at the State House, which is, you know, lawmakers are wary of using one-time dollars for something that will be an ongoing expense. Is it just about being careful about how you use this huge influx of money?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't open up a whole bunch of new programs and, you know, increase eligibility for things like full-day kindergarten and then in 2 years have to figure out what you have to drop.
And Delaney, how do you think child care providers should best use this one-time money?
Well, I'm not sure it's one time, Brandon. I think President Biden's committed to giving additional child care support, and I assume since the Republicans are pro-life and pro-job and pro-education, they would be all for that. And we want people back to work, and one of the biggest barriers to work, and particularly certain types of jobs, is the inadequate or unavailable childcare. And if we can come to that crisis, address it, and get meaningful childcare with preschool and the rest for children, it's going to be a tremendous advantage education-wise and certainly an advantage to putting people back to work. So I'm not certain this is a one-time thing. I hope it isn't. I hope the Republicans are committed to helping particularly working moms, be able to go back to work by providing quality child care.
All right. Well, finally, former Indiana Health Commissioner Jerome Adams tweeted this week that when applying to refinance his mortgage, the company couldn't verify his former employment as the United States Surgeon General. Now, Ann Delaney, should banks accept a Wikipedia page as proof of employment, as Adams jokingly suggested he tried to do?
There are bureaucrats everywhere. I would suggest that Dr. Adams should get himself a different bank, someplace where they know him and like him and not have to rely on Wikipedia.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, is this all about personal banking relationships, really?
It could be. I refinanced an entire company in 10 days with a local bank, and it took me 6 months to get a mortgage. So from a larger bank. So I think local banks are the way to go.
Nikki Kelly, I mean, should a Wikipedia page for the U.S. Surgeon General be proof of employment at the end of the day?
Obviously not, because anyone can post on Wikipedia. But having said that, I'm glad, a little bit glad to see that it's not just sort of small-time peons like us who have to deal with this bureaucratic nightmare sometimes.
You know, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't work out, I'm sure we could do a GoFundMe site or a Kickstarter site. There are a lot of people who.
I'm sure Jerome Adams is really struggling that he needs a GoFundMe.
He's got the blue check on Twitter. That should be in.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.